One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're bringing you more guests from our 2020 webinar series. I don't know about you, but 2020 felt like it lasted for about a decade. Back in January 2020, it seemed like the Black Summer bushfires would be the worst thing we'd have to endure, and doesn't that seem like a quaint idea now? Hot on the heels of the bushfires, of course, came the pandemic, which saw Australia take unprecedented actions, both in terms of health measures and in terms of the fiscal response to the economic crisis that followed. In those early days, it was pretty hard to keep up with the sheer number of developments and announcements each day. The Prime Minister was giving long press conferences that lasted well into the evening, and all the premiers were doing the same thing.
We are living in unprecedented times.
The Prime Minister has caved tonight, rushing back from Hawaii amid criticism for taking a holiday while Sydney burns.
If you had your time over again and you had the benefit of hindsight, then would have made different decisions.
The virus is continuing to spread. There are almost 3,000 confirmed cases in Australia.
You can still go to the football, you can still go to the cricket, you can still go and play with your friends down the street. We now need to take action to flatten the curve and to slow the spread and to save lives. Again, I want to thank all the premiers and chief ministers for the incredibly good faith way they continue to engage in the National Cabinet.
The National Cabinet took some unprecedented steps, huge steps yesterday, to keep Victorians and indeed Australians safe.
Casting himself as the parent, attempting to wrangle pesky premiers on his journey towards a borderless nation.
I will not be bullied, nor will I be intimidated.
Order!
By the Prime Minister of this country, who contacted me this morning.
To get on top of this outbreak in the Northern Beaches, as people are coming together at Christmas, it's a reminder that we can't be complacent. The virus hasn't gone anywhere. We still need to be on alert. We still have to follow those COVID-safe behaviours, COVID-safe app, all of those things.
National Cabinet, it seems, has reached the outer limits of cooperation.
We'll get through this together, Australia.
In mid-2020, we had former Prime Minister Julia Gillard as a guest on our webinar, and she said that the pandemic reminded us that, quote, government really matters, and who is running government really matters, and that also she hoped that we take this sense with us that expertise matters from 2020. And at the time, I remember thinking about what it would be like to be the Prime Minister at such a moment in history, to make those kinds of huge and consequential decisions. And Catherine Murphy got to ask those questions when she sat down with the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, for her quarterly essay, The End of Certainty, Scott Morrison and Pandemic Politics. In the essay, Catherine Murphy goes behind the scenes with some of the key players to look back at Australia's pandemic response, as well as providing a portrait of Prime Minister Scott Morrison. And Catherine was in conversation with our Executive Director, Ben Oquist, and this was recorded live on Wednesday, the 23rd of September 2020, and things may have changed since recording.
To kick us off, I'll start with my question to you, Catherine. I'm not quite finished the essay yet, but I'm finding myself a little tense reading it, even though I was there for all of it. So much has happened this year. Early in the essay, you do talk about bearing witness. Why is it so important to document what's going on behind the scenes in times like this?
Well, yeah, thanks, Evan. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. It's really lovely to be with you all. It was very important to me in this essay to document what happened. I did treat it as a first draft exercise, like that I was obviously highly engaged in the daily reporting of the pandemic, and the quarterly gave me an opportunity to try and put together as forensically as I could from multiple perspectives how Australia responded to the first wave of coronavirus infections. And it's one of these issues. You said, I think a minute ago, Lovie, that it felt like a decade, right? And it does. There will be a million books written about this. There will be a million PhDs written about this from a governance perspective. It's a really important bit of history. So journalistically, I wanted to get it down as accurately as I could. What happened? What deliberations happened? How people felt as they were making these decisions that were really high octane decisions and consequential for the country. And so I just thought that would be a resource. If I could get it, I could capture a period in time that was very important. And also, I've had this instinct all along, right? Because some very profound things happened during that period of the crisis in terms of what you flagged a minute ago, what Julia Gillard said about the importance and the role of government. We saw a coalition government basically fundamentally change its character in full public view and make a bunch of decisions that that a Labor government would have made and in fact did make during the last global financial crisis. So I thought, because there is this strange, because the pandemic messes with your sense of time, it really does. It's hard to keep the timeline straight. I thought the further we got away from these initial decisions, we would forget them. They would be overcome by the next challenges and the next thing that happened and the next bit of drama. And from my vantage point, some really extraordinary things happened in those months. And I just thought if I could just get them, catch them, it's sort of like running after a kite that's blowing high in the sky or whatever, right? You're running after it. You want to grab it. You want to capture it. You want to get it down for history, for the public interest, and just so that we didn't, the further we got away from those events, start to view them differently than how we did in real time, if that makes sense, right? Because obviously as time goes on, you look back on events, you view them differently than how you viewed them in the moment. So that was, anyway, that was the ambition. That was what I was trying to do.
Catherine, you've got a lovely way of weaving the interview you did with Scott Morrison through the essay. You write, though, at the beginning there that... You think that both you and the Prime Minister understood that there was little that either could do for you. why do you think the Prime Minister did the interview with you? Because you point out, I think others have too, that he's not want to give those kind of sit-down, reflective style interviews. So I guess there's two questions in that. Why do you think he did it? And why do you think he generally doesn't do such interviews?
Yeah, good questions both. They were interested in terms of why he did it. The office were interested in the project from the start because I explained what I was intending to do with it, that it would be part narrative history and part standard quarterly essay profile of a prime minister. So they were, because they obviously are aware, as we all are, that that history is being made here in all kinds of ways. The interview came in late. I did interview most of the other protagonists before the Prime Minister, so Brendan Murphy, Josh Frydenberg, Christian Porter, Simon Birmingham, because there were obviously big trade implications at the start, Jodie McVernon, who was the modeller at the Doherty Institute, and obviously a bunch of background interviews that I did with officials and others. That was all done first, and the Prime Minister came in late. And it was, I didn't, all along, I wasn't entirely sure that he would be interviewed because it's not, as you say, it's not his form. And I've explained this in the essay, it really is not this Prime Minister's form to do sit down print interviews. A number of his predecessors have, but Morrison does very few of those interviews. And also he and I can rub each other up the wrong way. periodically, and I say in the essay very frankly that I'm not part of the media clubs that with whom the Prime Minister does his interviews with, and I don't mean anything conspiratorially there. I just mean this Prime Minister does lots of radio. He does lots of bits and pieces on TV. I describe these interviews as yes mate interviews, and that's the genre that he prefers. He does a lot of FM interviews, all for a very considered purpose of getting yourself in front of the voters, but hasn't done many print. Didn't know if he'd do it, but he did. And I am really actually grateful to Scott Morrison for doing it, for taking the time, because we spoke for over an hour. I thought he was quite candid. There were things he didn't want to talk about. We might go there, Ben, in the conversation. There was stuff where the shutters came down and he really was not interested in the conversation. But he did, I think, reflect largely candidly on what had happened during that period, and it strengthened the piece. Those insights were important. So I'm glad he did it. I'm glad he did it. Like, it sounds a bit corny, but I'm glad he did it for history. And I think that's why he did it. He understood that was my purpose, and he wanted to participate in that history.
You're right that he really doesn't like the kind of ideas discussions or the philosophical discussions, and he runs a mile from them.
Yeah.
Is that a strategy, or is he not a reflective person?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very good question. And anyone who's read the essay will know that I really do struggle with trying to capture the Prime Minister, because he is a very difficult subject to get a handle on for a bunch of reasons. In terms of the ideology or the philosophy question, which is what you asked me, Ben. It's complex. I say in the essay that he's a hybrid prime minister. He's part campaign director, and he's part prime minister. And by that I mean, campaign directors are troubleshooters and problem solvers by disposition. Obviously, everyone's red team, blue team, green team, whatever you are. But at the end of the day, if you're running a campaign, your principal objective is what is our problem, and how do we solve it, right? And Morrison is hardwired to think about governing through that lens. So that's the kind of pragmatism, I guess, he brings to the office. My observation about him and philosophy is, yeah, he is bored. You can see him physically recoil at times. If you're sort of getting into kind of rigid ideological territory, or he doesn't talk about reform in vaulting terms as some of his predecessors have. I think in part he doesn't like constraint, this Prime Minister. He doesn't like weight. He doesn't like to be weighted. He likes maximum room to move at all times. And he wants to, he wants to have that flexibility. So if you're weighted by a set of fixed values, you can't move as fast. And this guy is a very fast mover. So I think it's partly that he doesn't like constraint. He likes to be able to see a problem and approach it with maximum room to move. So it's partly that. And partly, I think he sort of views a lot of the policy or the philosophical discussion that we have in Australia as sort of plotting very familiar paths and lines. And I watched him in the crisis, for example, like just one example, when he brought in Nev Power, who is a ex-Fortescue executive, to run the COVID commission, for example. And then there were a bunch of, he created this kitchen cabinet of business leaders and Greg Combey and other people, right? He scratched them, brought them all in together. And from them, I think he heard what he thought was a different dialogue, or a different set of constructions around policy and around ideas. And he was quite taken with that in the early phases of the crisis. It's like, oh, I'm hearing a different script, or I'm hearing a different approach. Now, I mean, I might think it's not fundamentally different at all, but from his perspective, it sounded different. So that's a long-winded answer to your question. He doesn't like constraint, first point. As a person, as a politician, he is pragmatic and flexible and likes to bring that into every equation. And I don't know, perhaps he's bored with how the policy conversation goes. I don't know. It's not his bag. It's like for some politicians, that's all there is. There's not much more than that. For this guy, there is more than that.
It's interesting. So do you think then he's potentially a prime minister for the times? I mean, given what you just said then, you're not going to describe him as a conviction politician,
no.
In the way many people describe John Howard,
yeah.
And that he's an ultimate pragmatist. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of talk about how there are no ideological constraints in a pandemic and we're all Keynesians now. Therefore, do the times suit him?
Mm-hmm.
I'll ask it a slightly different way as well, is that there was a lot of criticism over his handling of the bushfire crisis, and he seemed to not have good political instincts in how to handle that. Is all this because he learnt the lessons slowly in one sense, because he didn't respond well with the bushfires in Hawaii, but quickly in another, because yeah. he's completely transformed himself. Lastly, though there is that opportunity in these times of crisis to be that ultimate pragmatist, consensus-style prime minister, and there did seem to be an opportunity to forge that consensus-style prime ministership, but you'd have to say at this half of the back half of the year, yeah. it doesn't feel like that now.
No, exactly. Okay. So working through those things in turn, pragmatism, do the times suit him? Well, yes, I think is the short answer, particularly at the start, even though he was and the government were really panicked is the wrong word, because I never saw any of them panic. But they were under stress that is difficult to explain how stressful that opening was. But anyway, setting that to one side, it's a double proposition with Morrison. I say in the essay, I wonder, to borrow from Gertrude Stein, perhaps there's no there, right? Like perhaps, because I keep looking at this guy and say to find his essence, and I'm still looking. You're right
that the more you look, but the less you see.
The less you see. That's the confounding thing about it. The more you look, the less you see. Anyway, there's no there. So at one level, that's a sort of absolutely kind of to the heart. It's like a rapier to the heart at one level. It's kind of like there's no there. I mean, if someone said that about me, I would be horrified. But at another level, his pragmatism was necessary for the country, absolutely necessary for the country. You can think about if Tony Abbott was confronted by this pandemic, even Malcolm Turnbull, who is, a reasonably pragmatic character, but although very fixed in certain propositions, that we would have seen a different response because there would have been... a set of propositions that those two guys would have had to fight through in order to get to a response, right? Morrison was not encumbered by that. So his pragmatism served the country. So I think both of these things, I tried to bring out both of those points in the essay because I think that they are valid. Pragmatism can be a sort of head scratcher and a worry, because you think, well, what's the limits of action? What will or won't this guy do? But we actually needed him to do what he did during the crisis, and what he did in the opening months of the crisis was remarkable in terms of where he repositioned the government. Right. So there's that. Now, what was the second? What was the second point? There was
I'm interested. Did he learn at all from his mistakes in the bushfires?
Bushfires. Thank you. So we had, and I say in the piece that we had two federated crises crises in Australia this year. And by federated crises, I mean crises that the premiers largely have to manage. The first was the bushfires and the second was COVID. We all saw the Prime Minister fumble the handling of the bushfires in full public view for a bunch of reasons. One, that the Liberal Party really struggles to talk about climate change was obviously a really important part of the fumbling. But it was also a lesson Morrison had to learn about being the Prime Minister of the Premiers, which has been the COVID lesson, right? It's how you project yourself as the leader of the country in a crisis when you don't have a hands-on role. And that's where Morrison struggled. It's like he likes levers. He likes having something tangible to put his hand on that he can utilise and form a narrative around. And in the bushfires, of course, there was nothing. So he famously said, "I don't hold a hose, mate," right? Which is sort of one of the iconic things he said in the bushfires. It was quite a revealing thing to say. It's sort of because it tells you about how the Prime Minister thinks. It's like, if I haven't got something practical to do here, what am I doing, right? And that was sort of the principal thing he learned out of the bushfires, that you can either be stranded in the Federation or you can be the leader of the Federation. And he determined in the bushfires, I think, although funnily enough, again, one of those no-go zones in the interview was that the Prime Minister did not want to reflect directly on lessons that he learned during the bushfires. He shut that down quick sticks. But what I can observe, watching him every day, most days, is that he learned in the bushfires how not to be stranded in the Federation. So he projected that into the second crisis, which is why they created this national cabinet structure on the hop in a Parramatta football stadium. And he resolved to be the Prime Minister of the Premiers, give himself a leadership role, basically front their collective decisions, try and work through a process of collaboration and consensus. So he did much better in the second, which proves that this guy, as you say, sort of learns slowly and learns real fast. So that was what we saw with that. And then there was a third proposition. Ben, I should have brought my notebook in, love, to make
a note. Right.
No. I
wrote a piece at the beginning of the year that The Australian ran off the front page praising the Prime Minister.
Yes,
kind
I
of
remember.
Making, yes. making some big decisions that were in our interest, listening to the science and making the right decisions, despite some howling calls from the right not to do it. And it felt like there was a moment there where the Prime Minister could be a consensus-style Prime Minister. But in the back half of the year, it doesn't really feel like that now.
Well, excellent point. And obviously the essay captures the bit where things could have changed and now we're in a situation where it looks more likely that they won't. But anyway, one of the dynamics in the essay, it's sort of, there's a lot of kind of sub-themes in the essay or sub-plots, I guess, for want of a better term. And one of them is the relationship between Scott Morrison and the firm. And by the firm, I mean the Liberal and the National parties, right? Because there are many people in the Liberal and National parties who are not infinitely pragmatic or flexible, who have very set, firm ideas about what Liberal and National parties in government do and don't do. And so the Prime Minister has had license during a crisis to do what he and the top echelons of the government thought needed to be done in order to preserve, as he puts it correctly, I think, throughout lives and livelihoods has always been his locution, right? So he had a lot of license. But the longer events went on, the more tugging we see at the coattails too. And the essay tries to draw that dynamic out. And we've seen in recent times, Ben, I think, his own people, the colleagues in the government, particularly when Parliament has been sitting, reminding the Prime Minister in so many ways that he is not the Prime Minister of the Premiers. He is the Prime Minister of the Liberal and National parties. And he needs to articulate that view of the world rather than being the guy, the consensus guy, the guy who
sort of tries to draw people together across the divide and manage a crisis. So that's the period we're in now, where Morrison, I think, still part of Morrison thinks, I'd really like to be that consensus guy. But there are the requirements of the firm as well, right? So then we've seen the outbreaks of partisan politics, the carpet bombing of Daniel Andrews, the full frontal offensive on Palaszczuk the other week about borders. That reflects the base, right? The core coalition voters, small business people, open markets people, they're very frustrated, obviously, in the COVID environment where businesses have, let's be honest, been destroyed or damaged as a consequence of these public health restrictions and inhibitions on freedom. Morrison has got to articulate the views of his own base as well as managing a crisis which requires a different set of actions. So that's where we are now. My gut feeling is we're coming off a high point on a downward trajectory. That's what it feels like. And that feels like a shame. It feels like a pity. But I understand if you pull apart the dynamics, it's pretty easy to understand why that's happening and where those various pressures are coming from.
I'll just interrupt to say we've got about 1,745 people joining us today. So thanks very much for coming along, everyone. Ben, we've probably got time for one or two more questions before we come to questions from the audience.
I was going to get into your colleague Sarah Martin's reflections about
The Artful Dodger.
The Artful Dodger, because I went to school with the Prime Minister. He was in the year below me there. I don't remember that play. I remember a different one. But we won't go there.
Well, we've never talked about that. Anyway, interesting.
He, being in the year below, I think he remembers me more than I remember him. But, I don't know. one of the things that seems apparent is while he's an ultimate pragmatist, I was very interested in your observations from Arthur Sinodinos in the essay about politics being, you get so consumed by events, kind of his different, Sinodinos's reprisal really of events devoid events in one way. And he says the difficulty, of course, you've got to make decisions in real time with imperfect information. That's at the heart of what you do. Yeah. Somebody has suggested to me that, on the one hand, Morrison gets all the big calls wrong. He was wrong on JobKeeper to start with. Face masks, lockdowns, kind of was dragged, kicking and screaming to them all.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he does get there, and maybe that's what will make him a long-term prime minister. Does he have good political instincts? You would expect so after having been, that campaign director role. But, masks, lockdowns, job seeker, job keeper, it didn't seem like he went there fast.
No, that's true. And that's they're all very, very valid observations. And obviously everybody's judgment, just at a human level, everybody's judgment is variable. We are humans. Sometimes we nail it. Sometimes we get it catastrophically wrong. That's what humans do, right? And contrary to popular belief, politicians are humans. I think I wouldn't put it quite in those terms that he gets it wrong very often, although I wouldn't dispute that. I think what I would say about that is that there was this dialogue between the levels of government in the Federation that was very important to all of those leaders and ultimately really important for the country. So, and everybody kind of manned or womaned their corner in that dialogue, right? Morrison was sort of more, particularly at first, more preoccupied with the economic impact of the crisis because that's the Commonwealth's role. The premiers were very, very focused on the health impact of the crisis because that's their role. And everybody had to sort of represent their own interests or the interests of the various corners of the Federation in those discussions. So it's kind of like an ambit claim, you know, between a sort of employer and an employees. You know, it's like it's sort of like everybody has to do that in that conversation. You sort of have to safeguard the interests of the Commonwealth and the taxpayers. You have to safeguard the human interests of the taxpayers in the Commonwealth as well. And then somehow you've got to reach a landing point there. So I guess that's just what I'd put it through a slightly more nuanced frame, that it's like at one level, yeah, sure, he did get it wrong in the sense of obviously they didn't start with the wage subsidy, although he says to me in the essay that it was always in the back of their head and always part of their calculations. Other people involved in those discussions have different recollections of that. So, you know, that was wrong. And he was too slow. I think the thing that concerned the premiers, particularly in the opening weeks, that sort of critical month, say between, well, it's probably a month and a half, really, between the middle of March through to sort of the beginning of May, say, right, that they were too slow, that they were running behind the pandemic. And that was because, you know, Morrison's hesitating on national lockdowns or hesitating on the next bit of, yeah. So it took them a while to sort of get their tempo in sync. But, yeah, I think it was more a function of that amazing, those amazing conversations that were happening within that group of nine leaders at that time, everybody kind of, you know, fighting their corner. As for the political judgment more generally, well, he saw perhaps there's some macro calls that he still struggles with. But I think he saw a pathway to victory for the coalition in the 2019 election that most people didn't believe existed. And he saw it and he went for it. And that suggests to me that the political judgment is pretty sharp. That doesn't necessarily mean that you get every call right or that you don't periodically make a total goose of yourself in full public view, right? Because I mean, the reason I love...
Like wanting to go to the football.
Well, exactly, like wanting to go to the football. Like, I mean, what are you thinking, mate? Like, honestly, like, if you could sort of pull out of that and step, like, be on the outside. I think this is the thing about government, right, which sort of, and again, sort of goes to Synodinos's point, which is where you started. It's not only the art of making decisions with imperfect information. It's making decisions in a hothouse where you can't stand outside the decisions that you're making, right? You're in that kind of really difficult crucible and try to then reflect on how this might look when it comes out the other end or whatever. That is really difficult to do. So, yeah, his judgment is certainly not perfect, and we could probably come up, you and I, 5 minutes in a notepad with 20 examples of things that have been, you know, really quite bad. But he's also... I wouldn't discount his political judgment because I've seen it. I have seen it in action, and when it all fits, when it all works, when his flow brain, as he describes it in the piece, works, it really works. So
you don't become prime minister and win an unwinnable election without a lot of political judgment. Well, of course, yeah.
It's like you can apply a significant discount factor because it's obviously this guy is as capable of any of us as being an idiot. But that's pretty formidable. What happened in 2019, that from the fall of Malcolm Turnbull through to the election, that is pretty formidable. Mm.
Is it all right if I go to questions from the audience now, Ben? Excellent. So the first one, I'll just remind people, there's a couple of people who've used the raise your hand icon. I'm just warning you, if you've done that, I'm going to call on at least one of you to ask your question live. So if you only accidentally press that and you can see a hand icon beside your name, now's the time to remove it. The first question, Catherine, is from Amy Hoover, who says, first of all, thank you for your excellent quarterly essay. And I will remind people, available from all good bookshops and news agencies now. I know about 675 of you pre-ordered them for being Australia Institute supporters. Amy asks, if you can't find a metaphorical hill the Prime Minister is willing to die on, Why do you think he wanted to be the Prime Minister? If not for a reform agenda, is it just for the power?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Well, in the piece, I don't describe him as a person entirely devoid of convictions, and I sort of reference his religious faith, which is very, very important to this Prime Minister, and it's a hinterland for him. It connects him to all the important people in his life, and it gives him a way of seeing the world. Now, by that, I'm not saying that he wants to be, you know, Australia's kind of religious Prime Minister, but I'm just saying there is, this guy does believe in stuff. It's not like he believes in nothing. He does believe in stuff. In terms of why he wants to be Prime Minister, well, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the ideas power dynamic. You have to fall on the side of power. I mean, nothing's ever that simple. It's, no one is ever in politics simply for the prosecution of ideas. Everybody in politics, or well, no, not everybody. Most people in politics are type A personalities who like power, who seek to acquire it and then seek to use it. And this guy is certainly one of them. Yeah, I think it's sort of like, but the funny thing about Morrison is that even though he is this sort of shape-shifting guy who doesn't like constraint, who likes all this room to move, a prime ministership is the sum of your decisions. This guy will have a legacy, whether or not he wants to own it or not. He will, every decision that he's made will create a legacy for him. The pandemic is a significant part of his legacy, as is what happened during the bushfires. So it's sort of like, yeah, okay, you probably, the straight answer to the question is, yeah, he probably likes power, like most people in politics, but he won't avoid the definitional things that he would prefer to avoid, right? A legacy is already in train. And the Prime Minister, like all Prime Ministers before him, will be judged by that legacy.
Bernadette McPhee, if you can hear me, I'm going to come to you after this question to ask your question live. The next question is from Kevin Maguire. He says, you write that there are two crises facing Morrison, but he thinks that there are three. Well, we've been focusing on COVID-19. What about the gorilla of climate change in the background and in light of recent announcements? What should a leader of our country be doing to approach this third crisis? And I guess if I can just throw in, a lot of the mechanics of the response in the first half of the essay were really fascinating to me. If you could reflect on why Australia was able to respond and listen to the medical and scientific advice in this case, but not when it comes to climate.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the I said a minute ago about legacies will catch, the legacies catch up with you, even if you like maximum room to move. And that is the counterpoint that the government has created for itself. The government made much of listening to the advice of experts during the pandemic, and we are all, thank God, like look at America, look at where we could be, right? Like, thank God that happened. I mean that with every fibre of my being. That was absolutely the right decision, and I'm so grateful as a citizen of this country that that is the decision they made. But then there is an obvious counterpoint about if you're prepared to listen to experts in one area that involves existential threats facing humanity, as pandemics do, then why on earth don't you listen to the evidence about an existential threat that is looming before humanity, which is climate change? So the government has created something of a rod for its own back in listening on the one hand and not listening enough on the other. In terms of climate, climate is that threat is an issue that never goes away, is the most important story, as far as I'm concerned, of any in my reporting lifetime. And we are transiting back to the climate and energy space, which is discomforting for the government because it brings back, you know, a debate, a very lively debate in this country about whether we're doing enough or not. In terms of what we've seen so far on the energy and climate front, I said this in something recently, there's sort of a minimalist version of what the government's talking about in terms of gas recoveries and other interventions, and there is a maximalist version. And the maximalist version is a catastrophe. It is an absolute catastrophe. The minimalist version is probably in the do not much harm set of propositions. And we don't know whether it's going to be the minimalist or the maximalist at this point. We've got to see how this all tracks. But again, just to make a broader point about climate action, because I'm certain that a lot of people listening on today will be very, very passionate about that issue, as am I. But I think one thing that I would make as an observation is that we are heading into a very serious economic downturn. Australia is already in recession. There are already more than a million people unemployed. That will likely get worse before it gets better. The case for climate action becomes harder to prosecute in that environment because people are very concerned about their material well-being. So I think people who care about climate action, all of us need to think about how we continue to prosecute the most important policy issue before us all in the context of the environment in which the debate is being had, which is in the middle of a major economic downturn. I just put that out there as a thought. For this is something that needs to be considered, because of course the Prime Minister is going to bowl up the gas-led recovery, so-called, as a plan for jobs, a plan for the return of economic activity, a plan for sovereignty, the return of strategic manufacturing to this country. All of those top lines will resonate with people. So we're in an interesting time at this point over the next months about how to regroup on around the science and how to put that in front of people. So I want to put that in your minds. That's call that homework.
Thanks. I've seemed to have lost Ms. McPhee, but Jennifer Stewart, if you're there, I'll come to you next. And in the meantime, the next question is from Del Groves, who asks, what topics did Scott Morrison not want to discuss, which you've touched on briefly?
I referenced one, I think, in response to one of Ben's questions, that was what he learned or didn't learn during the bushfires. He really didn't want to. I can't remember exactly what he said to me, but it was like he didn't want to revisit that territory. And he really didn't. He really didn't want to revisit that territory. I had a conversation with him about faith, which is a separate small chapter in the essay, because I've got a lot of questions about Morrison's faith. I'm really, really interested in it because it is so important to him. And it influences the way he sees the world and sees his own prime ministership. And I was hoping that we could delve a little deeper than we did into religion and faith, not because I want to present him as some kind of crazy religious whatever. I'm just genuinely interested. I describe myself in the piece as a soft lapsed Catholic. I grew up in a very different religious tradition to the Prime Minister. I don't think people who have faith are intrinsically weird or strange. I have a lot of cultural conditioning that makes that not seem weird to me. I wanted to understand more about his religious tradition and how it impacts him as Prime Minister. I got a couple of little insights, but I didn't go as deep as I wanted to, and that was a pity.
I think that was an excellent question, though, and thanks for that. It's a really interesting insight, I think, as much to know what he doesn't like talking about as stuff he's willing to put on the record. The next question is from Kath Naish. She says, you mentioned that Scott Morrison doesn't like feeling weighted. Mm-hmm. Do you think he feels weighted by the constraints of democracy itself? He avoids transparency and scrutiny both within and outside parliament. Do you have any insights into that, Catherine?
Democracy itself, that's probably a stretch. I wouldn't push it at democracy itself. He certainly doesn't like the parliament. The parliament is not something the Prime Minister enjoys, which again sets him apart from a number of his predecessors. John Howard lived for the parliament. That whole kind of atmospherics in the bear pit, that whole sort of high stakes negotiations around legislation, all that sort of stuff, that was like why John Howard got out of bed in the morning. Kevin Rudd, I think, was slightly in Morrison territory. I don't think Kevin Rudd loved the parliament. I think he saw the parliament as the means to implementing that government's reforms, but I don't think he loved it. I think Julia Gillard loved the parliament. She was a really ferocious parliamentary performer and loved that whole dynamic. And as did Tony Abbott. Absolutely, again, what gets you out of bed in the morning, all of that bizzo. I think Morrison, yeah, doesn't look, he's perfectly competent in the parliament in terms of how he performs, but I don't think he loves it or relishes it. I think he views it as a constraint on his time and a constraint on his agency. And I think we see that in all kinds of ways. This Prime Minister is more lax than any Prime Minister in my reporting lifetime about things like misleading the Parliament in an answer to a question or that kind of stuff. It's like it's not really on his radar. It's not something that is of particular significance. Now, I mean, I'm sort of in the process here about Parliament when the question I'm fully conscious is a broader one, like does our Prime Minister like democracy and does he like being accountable? I think he doesn't mind democracy. I've never seen any evidence that he would secretly like Australia not to be a democracy, but I think he's he doesn't like constraints from through the Parliament, through being asked questions he doesn't want to answer. He's happy to be asked them, he just won't answer them. Through to things like heel dragging on an ICAC and other bits and pieces. They don't love accountability. That is certainly a fair observation.
Ben, you've been in politics for a long time as well. Does that accord with your observations of Scott Morrison?
Well, one thing I was particularly interested in, maybe get Catherine to tell this anecdote from Nick Xenophon in your essay, because it is about how he sees Parliament, and Parliament is a place that is kind of necessarily transactional, but it's also a relationship, full of relationships, and they can change you and change policy outcomes. So I've always seen it as a bit of both. But clearly the Prime Minister sees it one way, Catherine.
Yeah. I love that story from Nick. Nick actually told me that quite a while ago, and I had to persuade him to let me tell it in the essay because he was obviously, as people are, sensitive about retailing private interactions or conversations that politicians have amongst themselves. That's difficult ethical territory for them to subsequently. I mean, some people rat each other out all the time, and others, kind of agonise about whether or not these conversations should ever see the light of day. Anyway, preamble. The anecdote which Ben's asking me to recount is a simple one. They crossed paths physically with one another during that weird parliamentary sitting after Malcolm Turnbull had prorogued the parliament, then brought them all back for the opening of the parliament to hand down the budget, and then we all sprinted off to the election. So Morrison was treasurer at the time. In those ceremonial sittings, politicians move between the chambers. There's events in both the chambers. They cross paths. Nick said to Morrison, "Oh hi, we should catch up, have a cup of coffee, just chew the fat, talk about stuff." And Morrison sort of almost physically recoiled from him and said, "Well, what about? What will we be talking about?" And Nick said, "Oh, just stuff like." I enjoy talking to you. And he said, I'm strictly transactional, mate, which kind of like put Nick back on his heels. Nick, as I'm sure everybody watching this knows, Nick's a fairly gregarious figure. It takes a lot to sort of squash him down in that sort of whoopee can or whatever, right? Like it takes a lot to make Nick Xenophon go, whoa, okay, dude. But he was really shocked by that, just how direct the Prime Minister would be in saying, look, if you've got a transaction that you and I are doing in the Senate, then we'll talk. But we're not just going to have a little, cup of coffee just to get to know one another or braid each other's hair or whatever we're going to do in that conversation. Now, most politicians would not handle it in quite so direct terms. But anyway, it's sort of, I wanted the anecdote in the piece because it's just a window on how the Prime Minister operates, and it was emblematic of a lot of other stories that I heard in the process of researching the essay about how the Prime Minister conducts himself with colleagues and and with other stakeholders. It was definitely an emblematic and anecdote, and it was on the record, which is why I used it.
Jennifer Stewart, are you there? You had your hand raised, but I can see that you haven't unmuted yourself. Did you unmute yourself now if you'd like to ask a question? No? All right. The next question then is from Carl Stevens, who, speaking of relationships, says, Catherine, it's clear that the relationship between Andrews and Morrison has cooled considerably in the second wave, possibly now hostile. Is that purely political or born of frustration?
Yeah, well, look, they have, thank you for this question. They, and the essay opens with Morrison and Andrews' relationship, which I think is, well, was certainly prior to the things hitting the fence, the most interesting relationship in the Federation. We do forget this now, but when Morrison came to the Prime Ministership in very sort of convulsive circumstances, obviously taking over from Malcolm Turnbull, the leader, the Australian leader that Morrison modelled himself on was Daniel Andrews. And they formed, I think in a funny way, even though they're two leaders who have quite different views of the world, I think there's a lot about each other that they understand. They had quite a functional and important relationship that was basically the spine of Australia's first, or our response to the first wave. And the essay opens with Morrison reflecting on their relationship. And he describes them in the essay as, or their relationship in the essay as, the key fusion in the Federation. And I think they were. Now, things have hit the fence, as we can all see. And I think if you were Daniel Andrews, notwithstanding the fact that the Premier, there have been deficiencies, obviously, in Victoria that are now well documented. Obviously, there were problems in hotel quarantine and the contact tracing system was not strong enough before the second wave hit. So obviously Andrews is culpable for things that went wrong in his patch. But Andrews would also, I imagine, be enormously frustrated with the Prime Minister. Well, not so much Morrison. He's mainly had Victorian ministers carrying most of the animosity in the public domain to the Premier. But Andrews knows what that's about, and that's about the Commonwealth making sure that it wasn't blamed when things went downhill in Victoria for the second wave. I think that's a great pity that their relationship has taken a blow, because I think, it's an important relationship for the country. They are possibly both pragmatic enough to hit reset on the relationship and start again, and for our collective sake, I hope that's the case. It's sort of that kind of depressing kind of partisan dynamic that's starting to creep back into things when you've seen these guys sort of be better than that is honestly really deeply disappointing.
We've got a number of people here who are interested in the Prime Minister's Pentecostal religion. You said it was something that you didn't get into as much as you had wanted. But can you tell us a little bit about that mini chapter and how much it does dictate his view of politics and policies and things like that?
I think, some politicians are just all out in the public domain. There's no private self, right? It's just, there's nothing left to the imagination. They live in the public sphere entirely. This Prime Minister does have a private self. And basically it sort of starts at the border of his family and his friends, he's got long friendships that he's maintained over a long period of time, and religion is important to knitting all of those people together. His religion, which is in the Pentecostal tradition, his father was religious, and so he was brought up in that Pentecostal tradition in the household. I think it sort of forms some. The religious propositions sit behind, certainly behind the Prime Minister's work ethic. He's in the old sort of Presbyterian or if you're thinking about things in that, he's sort of like a Calvinist, right? He is very work. Anything can be overcome if we work hard enough. He's an enormously confident person, Morrison. I think anyone can see that by looking at him. It's like, and he envisages himself as a captain coach of the country. Again, I think his religious conviction sits at the heart of that. I think it's part of what gives him stability, confidence, and a sense of purpose, a sense that humans have a purpose in the grand scheme of things, and they need to exercise that purpose, and that is, that's the will of God in exercising that purpose. In terms of how it, I mean, colleagues say, report, and I think I said in the essay that he's not particularly interested in the sort of hard policy debates that a lot of them were interested in, but was, of course, very interested in issues like same-sex marriage and school chaplains and things with a vaguely religious dimension, that he was more interested in those things than others. But again, that characterisation may be not entirely fair. And I've seen him at close range during the pandemic, working through all kinds of complex policy propositions with a lot of attention, right? So again, you want to avoid cartoonish pictures of people and stereotypical sort of pictures of people. People are always more complex than that. People are always more complicated than the cartoon that is sometimes, you know, steps in for their personalities. But it's important to him as a person. It is a core of stability and a very firm set of fixed values, whereas other parts of his life are not like that. It is a social hinterland for him. He wants Australians to know that he is a person of faith. He does that in sort of this, what I would call strategic showing, that he wants people to understand that he is part of the fastest growing religion in Australia, according to the latest census. So there is politics in that showing. In terms of, though, you know, does it influence his, you know, does, you know, does he disavow science? Well, no. The pandemic shows that he doesn't disavow science. Is it the absolute critical thing that is front of mind as he makes decisions? I very much doubt it, because it doesn't sit with his pragmatism. But I would like to know a lot more about it, just because I think it's pertinent and interesting.
And as a frequent panellist on Insiders, we've only got a couple of minutes. Final observations, Catherine.
Oh, God. What can I say? Well, please buy the piece. I'm really glad so many people have bought it. I'm delighted with the feedback I'm getting about it, which ranges from "you're an idiot" to "wow, this is the best thing I've ever read," which is generally how these things go. Send me your thoughts. I'm very accessible on socials. You live with these pieces for a really long time. You really do want to know what the world thinks of them. All range of opinions is fine. I'm just, give me that playback. And thank you for all coming today and listening, and for you guys for organising this. It's more than generous. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Catherine. And you can find Catherine on Twitter, at least, at Murfaroo, which was also the passcode for today's webinar. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to my current boss, Ben Oakquist, Executive Director at the Australia Institute, and Catherine Murphy, our special guest and my former boss, when she was the Chief of Staff at the Australian Financial Review, and obviously author of this quarterly essay that we've been discussing. Thanks so much, Ben and Catherine. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
This has been a special summer episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel. And you can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research and content. And we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an A-U-S. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Catherine Murphy is at Murfaroo, and Ben Oakquist is at Ben Oakquist. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. Remember, stay safe this summer, and thanks for listening.